Are you tired of working with generic IT providers that rely on you to be the expert? Arc IT goes beyond just fixing your tech headaches. They specialize in proactive IT management, BIM support, and data security for architecture firms. The team at Arc IT gets your tech so you can focus on doing your best work. Whether you're a small firm of 10 or a growing practice with 50 or more employees, unleash the full potential of your creative vision with Arc IT. Visit getarcit.com and schedule your free IT assessment today.
Gosh, the market's good, so you got all these people with a GC degree that used to be a gardener, you know?
Yeah.
It's the efficiency gains that make this a viable option.
If something goes wrong, we are screwed.
So this company is growing to be like the Amazon of builders.
The pre-made and pre-cut cookies that you just throw in the oven. And
that's more my style.
Yeah.
The building industry has long been reluctant to change. When things are going well, developers and builders have had no incentive to rock the boat. But now, post-recession, a shift in society and culture has ushered in a tidal wave of change in the industry, and there's no going back. Welcome to Spaces, where we explore and analyze how the building industry is evolving, from design and construction to management and economics. Join hosts Jason, Ali, and Demetrius as they discuss the evolution of your spaces. Hello, welcome to Spaces. I'm your host, Demetrius, and I'm here with co-hosts Ali and Jason. On today's episode, we're discussing the concepts of off-site, modular, and prefabricated construction. But first, each episode we want to start the show and begin with a market update, which Ali will lead us in. And one thing I really want to talk about is the huge news that Lennar, one of the nation's largest home builders, acquired Cal Atlantic, which I think is number four.
It's two and four.
Two and four to now make the largest builder in the nation. So, Ali, what are you seeing and hearing?
Yeah, so when that news came out, I don't know about you guys, but I read the article and I had to do a double take. Yeah. Like, is that real?
Yeah.
Like, really? Even after there was that acquisition, when Stanpak and Ryland went together.
Yeah.
And then Lennar's already acquired WCI in Florida. Mm. So this company is growing to be like the Amazon of builders.
Yeah.
They're acquiring and acquiring all these different different firms. But what we're seeing is it's kind of, you look at the management teams of both companies, it's kind of the best of both worlds. You have some of them that are more financial savvy and some that are more design savvy, and now you put them together and put them in a room.
Yeah.
And I think it could be really interesting. We don't know which direction with the Everything Included, which is Lennar's platform. We don't know if Cal Atlantic will, with some of their projects that are in place, if they're going to change their position or if they'll run through as is.
There's tons of questions with this because... Yeah, like you said, they're two different kind of styles of building.
Yeah.
Who's going to kind of lead where they go forward? What parts are they going to adopt or keep going? Or are they just going to get rid of the way that one does one thing or the other? It's super interesting for architecture standpoint.
I think if you look at it, though, if you're going from two and four to obviously ultimately the nation's largest builder, you're going to look for simplicity all the way through, because you're absorbing, you know, just the idea of the acquisition and then absorbing the companies together is complex in its own nature. So you're going to look to simplify. Now, I can't necessarily see them shutting down the option side and everything that Cal Atlantic does quite well. Lennar's obviously going to take over and get rid of it just on the whole. I would imagine they'd finish out or phase break somewhere and restart if they're going to do that. But I got to imagine the simplistic style that Lennar has, especially when you become the nation's largest, you're going to try to streamline as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of their mantra anyways. So I don't know why they would ever look to do something a little bit different than that. And who knows? I mean, we really don't know. There's probably going to be more that comes out of that. Obviously, Lennar's, you know, year end is this month.
Yeah.
So there's not a whole lot going on with them looking at strategy on that at the moment, at least from the levels that we would see. But I think in December and January, you'll start to hear a lot more of that stuff. And they're a heck of a marketing machine.
Yeah.
Which was peculiar because CalAtlantic released their earnings for the most recent quarter, and they actually were down almost across the board. So it was an interesting, not that one quarter represents their play, but it was just an interesting timing that they chose not to do their earnings call, and whether that was actually because of the merger or not, we don't know. I also thought it was an interesting PR stint, how they called it a merger versus an acquisition.
Oh, did they call it merger?
Yeah, but when you look at it, it says Lennar will acquire the shares. Yeah. So it was, I don't know if that was just for people that were working at CalAtlantic a bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, the notices that we received, you know, on the trade side was, you know, it was a merger. I won't say which company that came from saying it was a merger, but I think that's more just kind of a positioning, you know what I mean, as opposed to the reality.
Yeah.
The reality is it's an acquisition, and, you know, Big Brother basically bought out Little Brother in that regard. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. There's a ton of questions, I mean, on every side, on what that's going to look like, timing, response.
And there's a ton of overlap now, you know, if you look at specific regions, because they, I mean, they all had their own work that they were doing, but they were competing against each other. Yeah. So when you're both competing for the same groups, you no longer need that as many people. So does that brings up the question of, will there be a ton of layoffs now? And
You know, it's kind of funny. I don't know if you guys had it at all, but we do work with both of them. And that Monday morning at about 6 o'clock, my phone started going nuts with people from both sides. I mean, literally just like, what do you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't work for either one of these companies. You know what I mean? But I think from what the inner workings are and what they tend to do, people were trying to ask, and I was like, I'm punt. Like, I don't even know where to go with this guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it was one of those types of deals. But there's a lot of unnerving, because I don't care what it is. You're looking for efficiency and scale. And there's some, it's usually middle management that tends to strike a problem. I mean, at these levels too, it's, you know, when you look at middle management, you're talking divisional presidents and things of that nature, that probably gets a little scary. But, you know, there has to be some absorption. And when there's some absorption, you know, there unfortunately will be some people that, you know, there's too much redundancy.
Yeah.
But I wonder how bad that will be. So we talk about labor shortages in the industry, and we talk about it on two ends. So you talk about the people that are actually out there building the homes, but you also talk about the corporate level employee. And we're hearing shortages on both ends. And there's so much of that missed middle manager that a lot of people are like, we want those people that have 10 years of experience, and we don't have them. So I wonder if they...
I don't know if it's a middle man. I don't think... I'm not so sure that's middle management. You know what I mean? When I talk middle management, like, how many VPs of purchasing and that type of stuff are you really going to have?
Yeah.
You need more so directors of purchasing and, you know, contract admin and things of that nature that do the physical task-oriented work. You know what I mean? Not necessarily strategizing and looking how you're going to buy different things from that regard. You know, same thing with field. You know, any of the gentlemen that are running, or ladies that are running job sites in the field, that job still needs to go. So that CM and that assistant CM are probably good. They'll ultimately, I think, look at ratios, right? So if one company's heavy in ratio and field help to another, they might decide what's better or not and see where that goes to. But I generally think it's the ones that are outside of the task-oriented work. That's where you start to look at it and say, where are you heavy and what's redundant?
Yeah.
You know what
but
I mean?
But even if they get laid off, I'm just saying, with the shortage,
you'd think
suspect
they'd land.
They'll be able to find...
Yeah, it wouldn't be as bad as, I mean, clearly it's not the same as like a recession situation.
Sure.
Yeah. So there's still jobs that are needed. You're absolutely correct. Yeah. There may be some people that need to kind of, you know, swallow that pride pill a little bit and do something a little bit different.
There'll definitely be a lot of shuffling around and, you know, moving.
It's
going to
be
different.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is, because just like we were saying before, it's such a different platform on how the two of them operate their business. So I'm excited to see it, because it is evolvement. You know what I mean? In some regard.
And it's also concerning as well when you look at, you know, these two mega companies coming together. That's a lot of eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
If something goes wrong, we are screwed is kind of the feeling that I got.
Really?
Yeah. That was kind of one of the gut reactions that I got, was that's a lot of land. That's a lot of... construction all under one roof.
I hadn't thought of it that way, actually. That makes sense what you're saying. You know, I wasn't so worried about it from that perspective. I was actually looking for the little guys. You know what I mean? Like your private builders and stuff, who I think have had, and we've got a lot of relationships with with some, you know, mid and smaller private builders.
Yeah.
And they will tell you, and I know, Ali, you probably hear it, the struggles they have in trying to make deals work when they're going against these, you know, big machines.
Yeah, because they have the public backing.
They got the public backing. They got the cash. It's hard for these guys to get the funding and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, what are they going to be relegated to? 5 and 8 home projects? Because you even still have some of the, you know, like Horton, I know, was doing some infill stuff and like small infill.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to.
You know what I mean?
Scraps that are left.
Yeah. For infill projects. What are they going to do? I mean, do you almost flip it to just custom? But most people aren't doing custom either, and you don't really want to do that. And gosh, the market's good, so you got all these people with a GC degree that used to be a gardener. You know?
Yeah.
What I mean? So you're kind of worried about that, but I'm more so wondering what that landscape's going to look like. What is the variability of product going to actually be?
Yeah.
Because you know, you're eliminating a lot of that competition stylistically.
It's interesting too, if you look at some of the different builders, that they held good land positions and then they'll have a foreign entity. So we've done a lot of research on, my company's done a lot of research on the Japanese coming in, and they have financing options that match what mega companies, mega publics can do. So does that change the landscape of who then finances the deals going forward?
Like a land sea situation more so? Or?
So I'm thinking Stanley Martin Homes in DC. There's a bunch of other ones.
It's an interesting topic that we're all going to be, you know, affected by and following as we move forward. But you have to mention it. It just happened recently. So is there anything else market wise that's going on that's kind of standing out to you, Ali?
Yeah, and so one of the reasons we wanted to have our first big show be about different kind of solutions to housing affordability goes back to everything that we're seeing across the board. So commodity prices are up. If you compare where commodity prices are compared to last year, I think lumber is up about 20%. Mm-hmm. If you compare it to the previous peak, lumber is actually not as high from the previous peak, but other commodity prices, if you look at gypsum or plywood, it's just crazy. And so builders are faced with those challenges. We hinted on challenges with the workforce, land prices.
Yeah.
We know that land prices are crazy. And wages, while I do think that they're at this point of the economy, they are starting to show that there's some growth. That's after 7 to 8 years of pretty much
stagnation. Yeah.
And so we're seeing this huge divergence between what people can afford and what's being supplied. And how do you address that? And I think that's what we're going to at least chat about today.
Yeah. So modular prefab and offsite construction are techniques that can solve a lot of the issues you've mentioned, Ali. These are concepts of planning and constructing a building or fabricating components in a controlled environment like a factory, then shipping those components to the site for field assembly, similar to an erector set or Legos. This ultimately negates the need for improvising in the field and minimizes the errors. Actually, factory prep can be done at different levels, either just framing the building, or you can build fully panelized walls where the structural framing is in, electrical and plumbing lines are run, insulation, glazing, waterproofing are all installed. Similarly, modular construction is the use of repetitive units that are set on a grid system based on some specific item or need. As a history lesson, one of the first major feats of this technology of modular design and construction was the Crystal Palace. It was built in Hyde Park, London, for the Great Exhibition of 1851. It was a cast iron and plate glass structure that was 990,000 square feet, had a height of 128 feet. It was 3 times the size of St. Paul's Cathedral. The building design was based on the panes of glass that they were able to get at that time, which led to the grid system of 24 by 24 feet module. And that module spread both horizontally and vertically. The invention of that cast plate glass method made it possible to create this structure with the greatest area of glass ever seen. This design at the time was so far outside of the box, because typically it was all brick design with very little glass. Having natural light wasn't that great of a concern, but this building opened the door to a lot of future development and creation of the skyscrapers because of the use of the cast iron. It opened
everyone's eyes to something, a different type of construction, glass curtain walls, and the modular design led to the case study homes, which were locally or regionally in Southern California, a big statement to home design. This was a competition or experiment that was started by the Arts and Architecture magazine. They commissioned these architects to design homes that were completely different from the normal construction. This was during the post-World War II, so they wanted to have a experiment with a home design that could house a lot of people quickly. They didn't put any restrictions on these architects. They had some adherence to normal building code, but they didn't have the restrictions of ours typical zoning codes or anything like that that would tie the hands of the architects. They just wanted them to use new, fresh materials, new concepts, and really push the envelope as far as home design. They produced this letter that was published in a newspaper. I'll read a couple passages from the announcement. The editor writes, "Each architect takes upon himself the responsibility of designing a house which would, under all ordinary conditions, be subject to the usual and sometimes regrettable building restrictions. The house must be capable of duplication and in no sense be an individual performance." The editor continues later in the announcement, "Perhaps we will cling longest to the symbol of house as we known it, or perhaps we will realize that in accommodating ourselves to a new world, the most important step in avoiding retrogression into the old is a willingness to understand and to accept contemporary ideas in the creation of environment that is responsible for shaping the largest part of our living and thinking. A good result of all this, then, would, among other things, be a practical point of view based on available facts that can lead to a measurement of the average man's living standard in terms of the house he will be able to build with when restrictions are lifted." It's really interesting and amazing to read this passage from this announcement back in the 1940s and see kind of how applicable it is to today. We have these outdated zoning codes, these restrictions of extremely tight budgets in order to increase profit margins, and a lot of things that really tie down the ability to innovate in our industry. And if we were just willing to let some of these things go, we can create solutions for these issues of time, money, material, and labor. If we just had the opportunity to do these things and explore different concepts and designs.
Can we first address the idea that there's two different ways that you can look at this? And so one is what you were talking about, is you create one design and you replicate that again and again and again as it is. There's no design element. It's just kind of what you would imagine if you think a modular home.
Yeah.
The other side of that is companies that offer... one company calls it fully integrated offsite solutions. And so what they do is, you can pull up, where I grew up in the Midwest, you have these grand, huge homes that are beautiful and have all this design with them. You can create that house as well as you can create a contemporary looking mm-hmm. house, or you can create a box. So it's not just, a lot of people, the first thing they jump to is this box, ugly home, and that's not it.
And I think a lot of that came from historically when they kind of first took on modular construction for homes. In a lot of cases, it was, post-war housing, a lot of people that were displaced, or a lot of different situations. But these were, quick and dirty, just throw it up and get it done, just to get some places for people to go. And it honestly did look terrible. You're trying to take care of a situation in a very short amount of time. So yeah, it's not going to look gorgeous, but that mindset, that stigma kind of stuck with modular mm-hmm. design. Everybody thought that's what you did. And in some part there was a little bit of truth, because there was some limitation on what you could do. You had to be willing to put in the time and money to make it look good.
Right.
But with technology, advancements in technology, you have the ability to
to kind of make it gorgeous, to do all different types of architectural styles and, you know.
Yeah, and what I've heard too is a lot of the builders, instead of outsourcing the idea that someone else could help you build those homes, a lot of builders said, well, I can do this in-house. I'll just create my own factory and I'll just do this. And what you miss out is when you don't at least have expertise, you kind of go through and you make those ugly homes, and you know you can do it efficiently, but you can't build it to the custom preferences of the buyer.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, ideally you see that in any industry. Doesn't matter what it is. I mean, you know, Demetrius, from an architect standpoint, it goes as a drawing, then it goes to an engineer, and an engineer comes back to you and is like, this doesn't work. And you're like, no, make it work. And you have this thing that goes back and forth, right? So in any industry, that's the case. And I think what it's going to take in order to make it a bit more feasible, because we can probably talk about the objections to it, is you're going to have somebody that's going to go through it and prove concept. This can be done. And then somebody else is going to have, and here's key, right? An open mind to be able to say, I like that look. I like that style. I like the efficiency that comes with that. Cause let's be honest, we're rolling trusses to job sites already, which is primarily, you know, pre-assembling homes to a certain degree, and have somebody that's willing to say, okay, can we try this? Can we try that? And everybody be able to work within the same concept and idea and play nice in the sandbox. And right now that's not really happening here stateside so much. You know, we're pretty behind the curve as far as that goes. And you know, Al, you've had some interactions with some other companies that have been very successful with that. But it's got to move that way, because we can't keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. And I'll be honest with you, when we talk, here's the other thing. You talk about labor shortage. That's just one part of it. I think when you look at it from a labor shortage standpoint, the skilled labor is not there either. Mm-hmm. So you're basically taking as many people as you can find, trying to fill holes and put it, you know, looking at it as hands, as opposed to how many of these guys really know what they're doing. You know what I mean? And hopefully you have the right supervision and such to help with that. Mm-hmm. But I don't care what anybody says. The best products come out of a factory. You know what I mean? And if it's a well-oiled machine and it's factory built, your potential to have less issues and less have less people making decisions that you probably don't want making decisions, you know, the better off everybody might be, you know, but it's a little closed-minded at the moment.
And there's a lot more control. You're not held up by weather or things like that. You're in the same position doing the same thing, and you have some repetitiveness to it in a controlled environment. You're not standing under the beating sun. Just it's a much more comfortable environment that people will be willing to do, as opposed to being out in the field.
And what you both hit on, we're kind of dancing around the fact that it's the efficiency gains that make this a viable option. It's not that a lot of these companies can necessarily provide a cheaper home, because you still have to work through, there's still the upfront costs, but what we're seeing is, if you can get the home to market 10 days sooner, there are all of those, with your financing costs, there are different gains that come with the fact that you can build it quicker. So I think a lot of people say, well, it's automatically going to be more affordable, and that's not always the case.
Right.
And that's something that we probably should address too, because it's not necessarily an affordability thing. Like you said, when it's built in a factory, it's going to be better too. So it's quality and, in theory, price.
Yeah. And obviously the thing with that, like, you can have things that are built in the factory and struggle. I mean, it depends on the type of management you put behind anything, right? Let's be honest. But I know from some of the stuff that I'm involved in, when we took the potential for hands to do the work as opposed to machines that you deal with tolerances and maintenance on, the overall product is not even comparable. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, truly, and I do mean unfortunately, because you don't want to necessarily replace jobs. It's not the point. But you may be able to provide more and give those individuals a better opportunity to become more and more skilled in working those situations, which ultimately means too, they could have a longer career, because they're not doing everything physically anymore at this point. So there is a lot to be gained from that. I think too, what you could do with, and what we deal with a lot in the industry right now, is inspection issues and those types of things. Well, you could eliminate a lot of that. Maybe you have, you know, there's different ways to look at it. Can you get a city inspector or something like that to go okay with the process and have checkpoints along the way, much like you do, like quality control? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There may be ways to do that where you look at, you know, and there's a couple that you probably touch on, but, you know, the wiring and the plumbing and everything that's going through some of these walls that we're building, and saying, yep, everything checks. You check 1 out of 10 or whatever the deal is, because if it is machine built, just like you would do in any assembly factory, you're not looking at every single part. You're randomly checking for quality issues and things like that. So You know, I think there's more than just the cost saving perspective. I think it may be a solution for some of the other problems we continue to face, which is more so a time save.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know definitely. What I mean, and an ability to make things a bit more smooth and consistent.
In Japan, so they use a lot of the prefab housing in Japan, and they use robots in different parts of production. And when you read about the Japanese and their take on robots, they're not saying, I'm afraid that the robots are going to replace my job. Right. They said they're going to help me do my job better.
Right. Yeah.
So it's an interesting, a different take.
Yeah. I did a recent look at some of this topic. Some of the things that I saw in some studies that they say the cost can actually be reduced by 10 to 15% and your construction time can be reduced by 3 to 8 weeks. Obviously the product type and complexity of the project will have an effect on that, but that's pretty huge.
That's 3 to 6
3 to 8 weeks, especially in a housing perspective. If you're trying to turn around homes, that's a huge difference.
It's massive. And I think the other thing too behind that is it becomes one of those things where you can count on it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
From a time perspective, and especially when, you know, our builders, their main focus is obviously keeping the home buyers happy. Mm-hmm. It's not a good thing when they're bouncing dates on them. You know, I mean, think about it ourselves. If we're, you know, selling a home or whatever the deal is, we have a move-in date or the lease is up or whatever, and we're planning on moving in, you come back and tell me I can't get in for another week. Like, that presents a massive problem.
Yeah.
So I think emotionally, and what is probably one of the biggest purchases of anybody's life, which is highly emotionally draining, you don't want to mess with those types of things. So it may give you a little bit more accountability in that regard. But I mean, and you said, what was the percentage? 8, 6, 8? No.
10 to 15%.
Yeah, on the cost reduction.
I mean, Ali, you may know, but most builders are not trying to hit double-digit percentage returns on every single house. So that in of its own is, you know, doubling or tripling could be potentially what they're looking at.
Yeah, and what we're seeing is the company that I mentioned earlier is Integra, and they're based here in California. And I've been fortunate enough to chat with their CEO a few different times, and what he said is they're now at, I'd say, over 50% of the top builders in the U.S. are saying, hey, I know that you guys are doing this.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm interested.
That's impressive because, you know, the most of the things that I've heard along the way, and there's one that's out here that started with it, that, and we were involved luckily on the ground floor with just the small portions that we do. And I saw it and I was blown away. I mean, tutoring the family, I'm like, this is where we got to go, you know? And I think to Demetrius's point, you know, originally when this concept came out, everybody, you know, saw what was produced. Like, oh, this is terrible. This is terrible. Yeah. It's like, no, this is just a term.
Yeah.
Like, you need to understand, you know, this is just a term. And an economy car doesn't have to be an ugly car. You know what I mean? Like, it really doesn't. It can be just, economy doesn't mean bad. It just means smart. You know what I mean? And so modular, I think there's a lot of ways to do, or I think they flipped it, panelized building or whatever the deal is, but I think it's the way it's got to go because there's so many compelling reasons for it. It's not you're trying to solve one issue right now, or we're looking at just one main issue in the industry. We're looking at multiple reasons for it.
And I like what you said there is like the economy car can just be smarter. I saw one comparison was actually two typical construction and modular was the typical is actually baking cookies from scratch. And your modular was buying the pre-made and pre-cut cookies that you just throw in the oven. And
that's more my style.
but going back, what you said about the smarter smart design for your economy car, and that's what this whole concept will take to move to the next level, is people have to understand to get the benefit out of it is being smarter. You have to have all of your designers, your architect, your engineer, your mechanical, electrical, plumbing, and you have to have everyone on your build team in the room.
Right.
You can't bring in your marketing people, your purchasing people way after the fact.
It's a mentality shift.
Everybody has to be there up front to come up with the design from the beginning, and everybody's input is there so that you can work it out and make a smart design and incorporate that into the system as you move forward. And that's one of the disadvantages, is until we understand that, people are going to trip over themselves because they won't understand that you can't, it's not a flexible system, so you can't make all these changes later on. So
But I never thought I would say this. So for our industry that we like to always laugh and say it's so far behind and it's run by people who aren't trying to rock the boat,
yeah,
we have seen companies are actually being receptive to this. I think people realize there actually is something serious.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me like, to use the phrase, the C-suite. So the CEOs and the CFOs and the COOs that actually have the meetings with the companies that say, hey, no, this is really a viable solution. They seem, once they get the education, like they're willing to change their mindset.
Yeah.
But then it's kind of filtering it down the whole system of people who say.
Yeah. I mean, and I think of it, so, you know, she's laughing when she says C-suite because it's the first time I'd ever heard it. And I think Demetrius was on the same page.
Like, what are you talking about?
But ultimately, I think what they look at, because they deal with the financing arm of it and everything that goes along, and they see the amount of time that they can potentially save, and they hear 10 to 15%. Now, whether or not it's 10 to 15%, I have no idea, right? And usually when you get into things like this, people like to somewhat inflate the number to make it look a little bit better. And I hope it's realistic. So they hear that and they're like, you kidding me? They're looking at their bottom line on however many millions or billions of dollars they're doing that year and going 10 to 15%, like bang, right?
Yeah.
That's huge dollars.
Yeah.
So I think what it is, though, is when we're talking about the mentality shift, the answer I get a lot of times when I talk to people about a lot of different topics, especially people that were bred in this industry, which I love. Well, you just can't do that. Cool. Yeah. I have no problem with that response. I really don't. But give me some more context.
Yeah.
I don't know
why
we can't do this. So if you could help me understand why that is, I would buy in hook, line, and sinker. But the problem is a lot of people can't answer that question.
It's typically, we've never done it that way.
No. You know what I mean? And it's scary. And I think part of it gets into as well, and we've even seen it in our own generation, and we're, for those of you that are listening, didn't have the benefit of it, but we're talking off the cuff prior to this. And there's people that are our age also saying that it won't work.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, those people that are saying it won't work, I don't think know how to use a screw gun, much less, you know, really put these things together.
So, been in the industry less than 5 years.
Yeah. And I really want a guy, I don't know why he can do it on site, but he can't do it in a factory. And if he can't do it in a factory, why can't a machine do the same thing if you program it properly? So I'm not entirely sure why that is, but we got to get away from that mentality. And even in the companies that I work with, we had that same issue in a trade where it's like, no, this is just how you do it. I understand, but tell me why, when we challenge this, why can't you do it this way?
Yeah.
And what we build, you know, I challenge the team. I said, if we build X, but they're able to put cars together in a factory
exactly.
with machines and basically no hands, why can't we do what's in our industry the same way? It doesn't seem nearly as complex. Help me understand that.
Yeah, they don't send your car to your house and then you start screwing it together.
It's not built on site in your garage and everything else. Yeah. So I think, you know, I think that's the main thing we got to figure out. How do we tap into that and get enough momentum for those individuals to say, this is not a challenge on what you know. This is not to get rid of your position and challenge your thought. But we want those thoughts that you have and that experience you have and apply that to how we make this work with all that experience that you do have. And I don't think we're there yet. And that's what we got to get to.
And what's quite fun too, is if you look at, I don't know if you guys have been on Toyota's website, their worldwide website, but they build homes. So they had the same thought. Toyota said, we can build the cars. We can also build homes. And so who knows? We always talk about this industry is ripe for disruption.
Yeah.
One day, are you going to be buying a Toyota home? Like, which is crazy. And in Japan, they do.
A funny story about that, and you know, it just jogged my memory that they do dabble in home design, is a company that I used to work for. We did a lot of work in China as well. And we had Toyota actually came and they were interested in seeing what we did and did a tour of our office and, you know, looked at some of our work. And come to find out, they actually, I can't remember if we gave them, sold them a design or what the exact specifics were, but we found out later they basically rolled our design over and did this massive production of that design over and over again. So it was interesting.
Well, it's interesting because if you think about it, Toyota revolutionized the automobile market, right? They didn't invent it.
Yeah.
They revolutionized it.
Yeah.
So, look, I'm a Chevy guy, GM, love you to death. That's all I ever owned. But ultimately, I respect the fact that they came in and looked at it, and they're able, because they don't have the knowledge, it's not so much that they're attached to that product anymore. If they're saying, okay, can I find a better way to do this?
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure they failed millions of times. They did, actually. They failed pretty heavily when they first got into the automobile market.
Yeah.
But they were willing to break it down and break it down and break it down and break it down and challenge and challenge and challenge until it became so efficient.
Yep.
They literally became the cream of the crop.
Yeah.
They created the just-in-time model.
That's it. And I am such a lover of just-in-time and how that all works because of how efficient that is. So I think you're right. Just-in-time?
Yeah. I didn't.
So literally you're producing. So if you look at it from a factory, if Allie orders a car to be at her house on, you know, the 5th of December, you're literally producing it. It's rolling off the line, getting in the container and showing up to her house on the 5th without storing, without doing, you know what I mean? It's like, it's literally like concept to deliver, like in so many days. And, you cut out the hand touches and the movements and the space storage and all these other kind of things. I mean, that's really...
Which makes sense one of our for
companies, in one of our companies, that's what we're trying to do is just in time with a 2-day buffer, only because some of our partners keep pushing on us and doing those types of things, and we want to build for a little bit of, you know, something could happen. But just in time is so efficient and so mechanized, and it's amazing because when you get into build cycles and schedules and things of that sort, you can start to move things based off of that on what you see forthcoming. You know what I mean? Oh, we've got to ramp up production. We've got to run another shift. We've got to do this and that. We've got to do whatever it is to be able to hit those dates. And the cost savings based off of that are huge.
And it sounds like it makes so much sense when you look at it today because they brought the just-in-time model to the U.S. in maybe the 60s.
Yeah. Huh.
But they came here and kind of, as Jason mentioned earlier, they looked at what was in place and they said, this doesn't work. Right. Like there are inefficiencies here. The old model was you just build them and you keep them in a stored.
Yeah.
And they were like, that is so much lost
money.
Yeah. It's like, just sitting there and you're paying rent to store that thing.
Paying rent, then you have the possibility that something gets damaged.
Yep.
You know, all these other kind of things that go along with that. You know, and that's why the just-in-time system is really what people should be striving to do. And essentially that is what a builder's doing. I mean, they really are setting a date and building that house to suit that date.
But there's so many things that can go wrong when you're out in the field doing that and moving that to a factory where you're way more controlled.
Yeah. I mean,
just makes more sense.
And it's a labor thing. And I was, you know, I was at an event last night and, you know, I was talking with the incoming president of our BIA and what his ideas were for the year and what he wanted to focus on. And a lot of it still has to do with labor shortage. I mean, that's the topic, labor shortage. And as I'm going through some of our, you know, year end with some of our builder partners right now, I mean, everything's a mad dash because we're trying to close so many of these houses and there's not enough trade power out there to do that. It's getting done. You know, I would argue how well it's getting done at times. It's not in the environment or the form that you probably want it. People are operating at too high a level, I think, too consistently. But this could help address some of that. You know what I mean? Not all of it. It's not going to solve all of it, but it could help address some of it.
It's an interesting concept that creates this rift in the industry right now. Yeah. I'm surprised that you said that CEO had basically experienced 50% of builders were entertaining the idea. Mm-hmm. I know of one that I'm working with right now that's looking at doing it for one of our projects, but I'm really shocked that it's so high because there's such a rift in how people see this concept. And there are some disadvantages, and that's because there's so much capital in play. Mm-hmm. People look at these disadvantages are turned off, so they're kind of waiting for
you want to see who's going to jump first.
Yeah, waiting to see who's gonna jump into this first and learn from them before they jump in and do it.
I think a lot of times it takes that outside company to do that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because they have nothing to lose necessarily and a whole lot to gain. And I mean, there's a lot of money that can be that needs to be invested, I should say, you know, from outside markets and stuff right now. So somebody can prove concept, I think they'd receive all sorts of funding.
And it's an outside company that created Europe's number one prefab company. So the company that I'm talking about, Integra, they created, I think it's called Century Homes in Europe, who's the number one provider of prefab. He sold it and he said, there's a huge opportunity in the US, I need to come here. So this guy has 20 years of experience. Plus we've kind of talked about Japan. He's gone back and forth to Japan.
Okay.
The world's number one home builder is named Sekisui. They build homes one at a time. And for architects, you don't have to worry about losing your job because you just give them the blueprint and they feed it into their system and it's done. If you buy a home from them, you sit down with their team and you create your home and it gets built in the factory. There is nothing, none of that spec inventory. This is what we have. Yeah. Take it or leave it.
Yeah.
It's very much a, if you like this house, like let's design it for you. And they still can provide it at a good price.
And I think one of the things that's interesting, I don't know the percentage or how much money goes into it, but the other thing that a lot of our builders deal with is they deal with what are called extras, and they hate that term, right? Extras. So when they're in the field, somebody screws up something, does this, and it causes another trade to do this, and so the other trade's going, I got to get paid to fix this,
yeah,
so on and so forth. You can really, I think, eliminate a whole lot of that when it's, you know, when it's factory controlled, you know what I mean? When it's in there, because most of the time what they have doing, at least in the examples that I've seen and I've toured, you know, one individual is trained in several different of these quote unquote trades. You know what I mean? So the guy that's putting the wall together is also putting the wire in, who's also doing the insulation, who's also doing the plumbing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Putting those pipes and stuff together. So he's responsible for that side and is literally signing off in a quality controlled area. This is my work. You know what I mean? So I think you can eliminate a lot of that. I don't know what the percentage is, so I don't know if it's a big enough play to really make a dent. I would imagine it is, but I can tell there's a lot of time lost.
As far as materials and redoing
materials work, labor on site, and, you know, certain trades not being able to perform because somebody else, you know, put something in the wrong spot type of deal. And
yeah, that same study that I was looking at, it claims that you can reduce material consumption by 15 to 20%.
I don't disagree with that at all. And because I've actually seen that occur on a factory side of what we do. When you go from, you know, individual hands making decisions and making cuts on site and doing that type of deal to having a machine that you're programming saying, rip off this much, do this and that, or whatever the deal is, you save a ton of material. And there's a lot of programs that'll efficient, I don't know the right term is efficientize or overly, you know, take efficiency to a whole nother level that you wouldn't even have been able to do.
And we basically have all the tools to do that. And I think architects have generally been pushing modular design for a long time. It's finally kind of made sense to the rest of the world. And specifically for us right now, like we have a drafting program. It's not new, but I don't know if you guys have heard of Revit. So, you know, AutoCAD, the computer aided drafting program. So when you use AutoCAD, for example, let's say if I'm drawing that bottle, I'll draw that bottle looking straight at that bottle from the front. Then I'll draw that bottle from the left. Then I'll cut that bottle in half and look down at it. Revit is a program where I'm basically drawing every element of that bottle to recreate that bottle in its three-dimensional form. I bring that up because it makes sense for modular construction. Right now, because of the time constraints that we have for turning around drawings, on a housing side, single-family detached, for example, it doesn't make sense to do Revit because the mindset isn't there yet. You have to crank out drawings really quick, and AutoCAD's a lot easier to do that as opposed to Revit. It has a lot of front-end design work and development work to generate that. But again, this is like changing the way we think of things. Everybody has to understand that you got to move to the front of this project and spend all that time, because you can form that entire bottle and understand every little nook and cranny of how that works. You can see how the wires, the plumbing, the structural beams, everything works. So there's no conflicts, and you have that all right there in front of you. And then when you move that over to the factory, it's all laid out. They know exactly where things are going to go. This is not going to conflict with that. And you can just basically crank this out a lot faster on the back end. But it does take that commitment to spend on the front.
I think that's what it is. I mean, it's being willing to tax your brain a little bit, to question yourself on what you're doing, to go in there and spend that time up front, as opposed to saying, you know what, just
figuring it out later.
You know what I mean? And what happens is we do it, you know, I do it from the cush of my own office, saying, look, I want it built this way. And then I have a team that has to go figure that out. And let's be honest, they're way better at it than I am. But ultimately, if you were able to take a hands-on approach with those guys to begin with and say, here's what we want to do conceptually, how do we build this? You know, they can take time out of it, you know, no problem, time and material, you know, I mean, it's just the way that it is.
And I wonder if Marriott had any play in kind of helping influence the mindset change, because have you guys seen that Marriott's now building some of their properties with modular housing.
I mean, look at all their resorts and stuff like that. I enjoy them. Yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, all they are is stacked on top of each other with a different facade either way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And so for them, they said, this is going to save us money if we do it. And I wonder if, as a CEO in the home building industry, you see other industries are willing to adopt this and look at their revenue, look at their earnings. They're doing better because of it.
So what's interesting about that is a thought that I was having, or at least one of the kickbacks I'd heard from some of the builders, is they're saying really the biggest hang up and the problem that they have with it is actually not their mentality. So not your C-suite. Mm-hmm. It's the municipalities.
Mm.
So
yeah,
if you look at a hotel and things like that, I mean, they're gorgeous, right? But they're a big, huge wall of glass and structure for the most part, with not a whole lot of appeal to it necessarily, right? So when you drive down a street scene and you've got places, I probably shouldn't call them out, but let's call them outskirt type cities that are newer, up and coming, if you will, that would still be tagged quote unquote affordable. You've got these municipalities that want it to look like Newport Coast. And it's like, yo, let's call a time out here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how we get to be able to affect them to understand that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very real example of one of the major hurdles to this type of stuff. Because if you are going to modulize different things, you're going to be limited to a certain degree. We have to understand what they don't like, so then we can try and really, you know, go in. But they, you know, it's also not the same to say, hey, here's a $7 million custom home that overlooks the ocean. I want our street scene houses to look the same way.
Yeah,
and that also took 2.5 years to build. You know what I mean? Like, it's just not the same.
Yeah, that's a huge problem.
You certainly would know.
Yeah, the municipalities are just not forward thinking in that way. Part of it is that they don't want to do it because they want things to look a certain way, the Spanish, Tuscan, whatever it is. And you can do that with a modular design, but they don't understand it as well. That's the other side of it. They're not pushing their staff to learn all these different concepts and understand where we can go. But I'm hoping that they start to understand that there's this need and we need to come up with solutions. So to be open-minded, send your staff to different workshops and events to learn all these different things and understand where we can go and be more open-minded to, you know, let some of this stuff happen.
Well, and you would hope, because I would rather have a modularized home that comes with some kind of stigma than a tiny house. I hate those stupid things. But they're like, oh, all these young people, they want affordability.
But there's a show on HGTV.
Yeah.
I mean, no joke, though. That's something I was thinking about was everybody, you know, tiny house. Mm-hmm. And really... I'm not going to lie to you. They sit here and say, oh, I really want a tiny house. No, you like the fact that it's 40 grand.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you can still park it on mom and dad's driveway.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know what I mean? But ultimately, it's an affordability issue. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think you guys said it earlier. Land's not going to – God only made so much land.
Yeah.
I don't care what anybody says, right?
Yeah.
So at some point, you become landlocked. So you're going to have to figure out other ways to slice and dice that land and still make your money out of it. You know what I mean? So are you going to be able to drop affordability to get people in there to buy it and do those types of things? Because there's still a big gap. There's too many people that aren't buying houses right now.
Yeah.
And at least – and I know I have a very myopic view as far as the region that I work in. But I know a lot of the associates that work with us and for us, and they're not in housing yet. You know what I mean? They don't own anything yet. And so what does that mean for our economy if we don't have people, you know, our industry, if we don't have people buying houses?
Yeah.
I know every builder has some kind of apartment, you know, division at this point, but still the bigger side's on the home building side.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it doesn't even stop at, so we're talking about people aren't even buying houses. It doesn't stop just at our industry. If you're in if you're in retail, if you're in any of those industries that are kind of down the stream, you benefit when people buy homes. That stimulates the economy when you buy a new couch or a new fridge or all of that. So there's a lot to be said for making solutions for this.
Yeah,
it's interesting for sure.
So I think we're kind of running up against it today. There's still a ton that I personally want to say about the topic, but we can hold that off to another time and wrap this up today. But I really appreciate you guys joining us, listening to the show. Come back and check us out in a couple weeks, or if you are listening to this and catching up, hit next. We'll see you then. Thanks.
Calling all AEC professionals. Get ready for unparalleled professional insights with detailed and original podcasts by RCAT. This is the podcast that brings you the untold stories and lessons learned behind the design and delivery of a building project. Hey, it's Charisse Lakeside, aka the CSI Kraken, and your host. Join me as we dive deep into the tales of conflict, triumph, and sheer ingenuity.
Yeah, so when Serena was named for the, it was going to be named for the building, you know, we really were able to work with teams at Nike Branding and how to really infuse her influence and identity in the very public spaces.
Detailed features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who spill the beans on the most complex, interesting, and downright odd building conditions they've encountered.
Another challenge of the shuttle is actually, and putting it in launch position, is how you brace that seismically. It's really supported by only two pins at the base of the booster rockets. And there's a large base isolator that's underneath the shuttle that kind of prevents it from moving too much in an earthquake.
When you have 600 people or 300 people in a room, acoustically, you really need a high floor to floor so that you can have the right acoustic environment for people to be able to talk, and that speech intelligibility is really good.
Every episode unveils lessons learned and connects you to the products you need to navigate similar challenges. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Detailed today and be prepared for the unexpected on your next project. Every building has a story, and we are here to tell it.